This is the Lean Into Art Cast.
Whether it's illustration, cartooning, UI design, or presenting, it all comes down to telling your story, communicating your ideas. But it ain't for the faint of heart. But let's lean into it.
Brosed of comicsaregreat.com.
Hey, Rob Stenziger of interactive-storyteller.com.
Yeah. So it's good to be chatting with you. Yeah. Good to see you too. Heck, we're recording a video episode.
It's a video film show. That's right. Mm-hmm. Every other episode of the Lean Into Art Cast will be a video show where we will hopefully bring some things that are worth looking at while we talk about them. Do we have anything at the top? Do we want to front end this with any stuff that's been going on, or do we want to just dive into this part two of the design series? I defer to you. This to me, Rob, is kind of like I'm learning from you. I'm looking at you. I'm saying, Rob, please instruct me on this. I let you decide the pace. Your pedagogy is the word of the day here.
Wow. Well, let's see. Ironically, my pedagogy is to pull pedagogy out of the people around me. So that is, yeah. I have the absorbent kind of kung fu. So,
so it's much more like therapy, where it's like, what do you think?
Right? Exactly. That's a very interesting observation. Why do you think that? because what's yes?
Answering every question with a question is all I was going to say. Nothing profound.
Well, yeah, there you go. That is now you have taken my secrets out of my chock full purse and dumped it right out on the table.
Well, that's also good pedagogy.
Yep.
Is to show that
I learned it from the Breakfast Club.
And smashing the cereal between two pieces of bread.
Yep.
No, but, you know, that is part of it is that you don't want it to be... Well, sometimes you want it to be a magic trick. It's fun when it can be a magic trick sometimes. As long as you don't lord it over them.
That's true. Well, I honestly, with magic tricks, I think that for most audiences, you have a willful participant that is giving you the benefit of the doubt, saying, you know, magic is real. So... let me still believe that and, you know, let's see what you do.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah. And as long as, I think the best magic tricks are the ones where the audience doesn't even know a trick's been played, right? Where you, the performer kind of I'm talking in terms of teaching now, when the performer disappears from the equation altogether.
Oh, it's kind of, yeah, those are kind of like a double blind study. Where you don't know what's being tested. You don't know the actual trick that's going on because there's a pretense of a trick.
Yeah.
That's totally baloney. And,
We're kind of like putting an epilogue on the end of last week's episode where we talked about like fun experiences. And like, yeah, my favorite teaching experiences are where the kids aren't even sure they learned something, but they had an amazing time doing it, you know? And then when there's been like one or two occasions where somebody actually says to me, like, I don't even know what we did today. And that I could like turn to them and say, well, what I draw something on the board. And I'm like, you know, which one looks more dynamic? Well, that one. How come? Because he's doing this. Well, you just learned something in class.
So you exactly. Show me sand the floor. Yep. Jinx.
Even with a little bit of latency, we still were able to do that. Okay.
Yeah. Nice.
So nothing that you wanted to make any noise about this week? Nothing you wanted to point people at that you did? You did a Polytechnicast. We should point people at that more often.
Polytechnicast. Sure. Yeah, yep. So I never recorded one today, so I'm forgetting the one I posted recently. But
Slag. Yeah. I'm forgetting it too.
It's no big deal. But that's one of the podcasts that we put into the feed at Lean Into Art, as is Thunder Punch Daily and Fabulous Secrets. To that Jersey does.
I've got notes for my upcoming episode. See, there's notes right there, which I won't sweet. Show any further than that. So I am recording more. It's just it's a time thing. It's a time thing. It's not an ideas thing. It's a time thing. But yes, people should go to leanintoart.com/podcast. I think that's where all the podcasts are kept. So if you like the show, if the show makes you happy, and you're like, I wish I could have more Rob in my head. did that sound bad? Then you should go there.
Not inherently.
Okay. But I got nothing. Right. I did some stuff, but it's on my blog. We'll talk about that later if we have time. So design.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, design. Well, here you go. You ready to get flipped? I wanted to seriously know what... Okay, so part of this design... I'm going to step back before I flip you. Design. We want to do a design series. We feel it's very important. Why highlight this as a topic? It's kind of a, hey, no kidding, guys. We do this all the time. We make art. We create stuff. Does it really need to be highlighted? And honestly, for us and for this audience, I say probably not. But it's still good to even look at things that, you know, we assume we know and we can possibly dig a little deeper and get more comfortable with it. But I would say it's not just for us. It's what we could all get practice in. I'm assuming all of us, but you know what? If anyone in the audience has ideas to, you know, shine a different light on this, by all means, share it. Go to leanintoart.com and hit the contact form at the bottom of the page. I think we all could be better advocates and I guess teachers of design, where we can sort of present why is it important, because we deal with people who need to benefit from it, both ourselves and our audiences, our readers, our customers, when we do visual communication for a living, right? How do we get them to feel like they have more of a grasp on design, and why would they want to care? So this is part of why we're tackling this. So I am wondering, you, Jersey Droz, when you go about your day-to-day visual communication, storytelling, what have you, what about it when you reflect on it? Like what affordances or concerns or aspects of design seem to stand out as like important, or is it?
Oh, a big one for me. I mean, see, a lot of my day job is not just freelance illustration. More and more it's turning to teaching, but then also being an event organizer. So I'm in the throes of developing Kids Read Comics right now. Yearly mm-hmm. event I put on with a bunch of other people. KidsReadComics.org, by the way. And in years past, I've been faced with going to a lot of meetings where there's upwards of 8-10 people who I have to communicate an idea to. And I can describe something to them. I can say, like going back to last year's Kids Read Comics event, which you were at, Rob, right, where it moved throughout the town. The event had several locations, so that it was at this library, it was at the clock tower, it was at all these different little spots throughout the town, and I had a real idea on how this was all going to work. I tried describing it in words, and people couldn't quite wrap their brain around what I was saying, even though they were natives of the town. Even though these people lived in the town, I'd say, well, it starts here, it'll go down to that bakery over there, and it'll go to the clock tower, and it'll move back here by virtue of scheduling the events at certain times. Huh? I distilled those ideas down to an infographic. I took a map and I worked out, here's the clock ticking as things are moving, here's some arrows moving around, nice clear graphics, and then here's an alternate way to look at it. We can look at it as a linear timeline moving down a page. Here it is moving horizontally across a page. I gave them four different ways to look at the same thing. The first time I presented this, everybody was like, I don't know, Jers, this sounds really far out. Then when I did the infographic with clear distillation of information through graphics, suddenly I saw the whole room sold on my vision. They were all like, oh, that's amazing. That's a great idea. So one of the things I'm learning real fast is that while I think I'm a decent talker, I think the more you can express visually in a meeting, the better. And I'm not just talking about bullet points on a PowerPoint. I'm talking about, like, distill an idea. Like, what do you mean move through the town? What do you mean that some events appeal to this audience and some events appeal to that audience? Like color coding things. I worked out a color coding system and a shape-based system where purple triangle means this, blue square means that. And there was, with that little quick introduction, now I could just use those colors and shapes to clearly indicate what kind of stuff is going to be happening where, right? Mm-hmm. That was all design, and that was a huge learning experience for me in learning how to execute this year's show, so as not to spend too much time debating, but rather get to the heart of what we want to do, and to find really good ways to display that information so that everybody understands, so we're not spending a lot of time on Q&A.
So through designing communication that reached out to people to express a lot of complex aspects and nuances of that event, you were able to make them all focused participants in contributing toward one shared experience, one shared idea.
Yeah. I went from a room of people doubting me, and I don't mean in a bad way. I mean, they were just skeptical of the plan. Mm-hmm. And by putting it into an infographic that made them understand, I didn't have to be as persuasive with my voice because the graphics were there to deliver the idea.
And or reinforce.
Or reinforce
the
yeah.
ideas. Yeah. It's, let's see. So that's one thing about design that I think is incredibly powerful is that it's not... it does to me. It's not about imposing some kind of external thing onto people. It's finding a way to reach them with where they are and the forces and what they know already. And so, if you're in a room that has a lot of light, you will have to design the communication so it has a lot of contrast so it speaks to everybody, right? So if you have some really subtle colors on a subtle background and you're trying to display a slide that is an infographic that's reaching out to everyone and you're sitting in a daylight conference room, that you may have trouble with that design, even though you've thought about some of their cognitive concerns where you're trying to highlight that you've come up with a system of symbols that doesn't conflict with one another that helps reinforce some other ideas. Ah, cool. And you're bringing it up right now.
Yeah, I was looking this for is while the, I was talking with you. This yeah. was one of the drafts of the...
It's like a magic trick, actually.
Yeah, actually, it kind of was. So this was in February of last... Wow, this is a year ago I did this. So yeah. I plotted out, okay, here's our three locations. And, you know, let me zoom in on this a little bit. So I just took... took pictures of the areas. Here's our three locations where events are going to be happening. I defined what different kinds of events we wanted to have. So here's invested attendees, casual attendees, and discovery attendees. Define them really quick. This was the handout I gave them. And I did a PowerPoint to go along with this. And then I worked out a timeline. Like here's how the events would move according to the time of day. Right. And then I did it in a different way where I broke it down in a traditional, you know, kind of itinerary. Like so. And then I broke it down this way where it's like, okay, here's the three locations and this is all side. Let me see. I can rotate this. There we go.
Yeah. That's better. Oh, cool.
So then, okay, here's the locations and here's the stuff all happening at the different times of those locations. So I gave them a multitude of ways to approach this thing and I gave them a much more graphical approach versus linear text approach. What are you going to say?
Well, I'm curious. Well, what do you think of how you broke down and presented the information, like which one of these visualizations was sort of the most, what were they most hungry for? It what seemed to make people go, aha.
This was the one right here, the page we're looking at with the shape-based visualization, the shape and color-based visualization. Because the big question was is that they couldn't figure out what kinds of events were happening at what locations at what times. Because another complication that we ran into, and I don't want to belabor this too much, it's just I had the example at the ready. But the big complication was is like, okay, so we're going to have full-on workshops, one of which you led for us, and that was at the library, right? So we had like big spaces for big room workshops where we get to fit 30 people in there for an hour to an hour and a half. But then we wanted to have, because it was taking place all through the downtown, we wanted there to be discovery events. So this is more of a spectacle. This isn't an hour-long workshop. This is somebody with a pad of paper on the street doing a quick draw-off, this thing called, we call the quick draw, where it's two people drawing on pads in an improvisational, whose line is it anyway kind of thing. And then we wanted to have sort of kind of walk in and out workshops where you don't have to stay for the whole hour. You can just show up for 15 minutes if you want. just hang around for a little bit, right? So we had three different kinds of events happening at any given hour, and we were going to try to orchestrate them so as to move the people through the town. Oh, you had fun here? The next thing's right over there. Go over there, and you'll see the next thing going on. So we're parading the people through the town, navigating them to the different locations so they'll see all there is to see. That's a hard thing to describe in words, right? I mean, I just tried. But when I did this, where I showed that, and I arranged the elements, like these purple boxes in the second tier, are designed to show that, okay, you're going to start up here at the 11 o'clock. Let me get it. I'm going to have to get the drawing tool out so I can, whoa, what happened?
Interesting. It just, jumped to the different page.
Let's see if I can get back down here. Okay. And it's not going to let me rotate it now?
Funny.
We just learned something about Adobe Connect.
Yep, learn something new all the time.
Well, we could look at this sideways a little bit because I need to draw for a second here. So I point out that, okay, we're going to get the people started here. They attend this, then they attend this, and then moving through these events, they're going to go through here to this, and then back up to this. And that gets them to move through all three locations. And then some people may show up before that, or they might arrive here first. How do we deal with those people who arrive at the downtown Chelsea first? Well, then we do this, get them to move back up. And what if somebody arrives a little late in the day at the library? Well, we've got this one to get them to go back down here like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot of doing, designing this. And this was a draft. This wasn't the final, but that was the hard thing to sell them on. And so by doing it as an infographic, now I can rotate it back again, and breaking it down for, you know, and anticipating a lot of different kinds of cognitive needs, right? So some people are going to go, huh, what do you mean teen workshop? Okay, well, here it is in a normal kind of linear form for those of you who need to see an itinerary, right?
Mm-hmm. And then people could just drill in with that simple view of time, even though the other one is another time-based visualization.
And this one has pictures of the locations next to the time where it's happening. So it's much more linear in the sense of here's the hours ticking away, but here's the locations sounding off next to each of those hours. So that's all I'm saying is that was a big learning experience for me of design being a huge key into winning or persuading an audience, getting them to understand your point of view, getting them to see where you're coming from, making meaning come across for something that is, as you put, and let me stop sharing this now. Get out of here, share screen. As you put on your screen, express ideas in ways that reach people in new ways, express and manage complex concerns. Long way of saying all that.
No, it was a great example too. I think that's one of the things that we can be at a loss for in this conversation is having something really tangible. So that I think that was awesome to bring up the detailed example because it's a squishy topic. We're talking about, well, why is communicating in a way, I'm going to crassly oversimplify this, right? Well, why is communicating better? Right?
Yeah.
Boy, you know, it sounds kind of self-evident, but it's more nuanced when you want to think about, we'll end up digging a little bit deeper into your example, but, let's ask the question, why do people have different ways of learning?
You want me to answer that? Because I don't got an answer. I mean, there's a lot of different theories as to that, right? I mean, it has to
well,
do with their,
but their we know it exists, though. I mean, so maybe we can't answer hit why, but then we can go well, what? Well, what are these different ways of learning that we have observed? We've observed certain things being effective to address communication, and we can at least observe what. And once in a while, we can indulge ourselves and ask why.
And there's other concerns as well. There's not just like learning styles. There's also what is the dynamic of the room? What is everybody's personal story? What happened to them that morning when they sat down to look at the thing that you're showing them, whether it's your comic, whether it's a film, whether it is a presentation? Are they distracted by something else going on in their lives and they just need it delivered simply and quickly, right? So I just got a comment on one of my YouTube videos. It was an instructional video that I put up a couple years ago. I think it was one of my Photoshop ones where it's like how to make blue lines in Photoshop. I think that was the one. And somebody put a comment, oh my God, so much talking at the beginning. Scrub ahead to the 2 minute and something mark, and then it gets interesting. And then immediately I thought of, like, there was an inclination to feel kind of like, oh, am I too wordy? Am I too talky? Did I do a bad job on that video? But then, like, that was about like a quarter of a second. The next second, I thought, man, how many times have I wanted to know something right now? Because when my sink broke and I'm trying to fix the darn sink and I'm looking up YouTube videos on how to fix my darn sink, and then there's 10 minutes at the front end of the guy going, this is a wrench, this is a washer, this is a nut, I'm like, just get to fixing the sink. You know, I gotta fix my thing now. You don't know what psychologically is going on with the person receiving the stuff too. So that's another one where it's like, maybe the quick and elegant infographic is the perfect thing for that person at that moment. But then somebody might be in a more pensive mood and they want to dig, they want to drill down. They want to really get some rich content here, and that infographic isn't going to be enough for them. There's a lot of, am I getting where you wanted to go with saying this?
I think you are. It's that there are a lot of factors and the world is complex, and how do you get, so you have a goal with your, does something's driving the need for you to make something, and having, concern toward design and what makes it better and how does it achieve that goal better? What is better? And figuring that out for your project. And it's going to be both defined on your perspective and who you're trying to serve, probably. And again, it could be just the context of, well, what time of day are you presenting? And that's going to change the kind of colors that might make sense to put on your slides. Or it could have to do with having some really complex data, which you can run into a lot, and think about what are different ways to present this to increase the overall comprehension, because the reason you're expressing it is to get the idea across, and you know that there will be different styles that will address crossing that line of yes, every, you know, person A comprehends, person B comprehends because of the second slide, person C, etc. And that's what this part of design, like, well, why design and the importance of design? Well, I think you nailed it with that example, in that one of the reasons is to communicate better and convince people. You want to bring them together to help, or maybe it's not about convincing. Maybe it's about getting everyone on the same page with the right question to then find the thing that they need to convince each other about. Like, you're doing a big
problem.
Exactly.
Identifying the proper question to be addressing, rather than kind of coming at it from the elephant in the room, right? Everybody's got their hand on the different part and they don't know what it is.
Exactly. And so what you can try to do is find a way to unify those perspectives. And that's one of the huge helpful things about shared communication. But I do think we'll probably hit that in general, because we're here doing the Lean Into Art podcast. We deal a lot with communication and storytelling and the visual expression of all that. And that's what we do quite a bit. So we'll lean on those examples quite a bit.
Yeah.
Jersey. Yeah. I don't know. I just,
No. I mean, you get no argument from me. I mean, anybody who is surprised to hear us say that is probably new to the show.
But I do think that other design disciplines, so we mentioned Charles and Ray Eames, yep, who they've done, well, a lot of different kinds of design. They're incredibly cross-disciplined, married couple from, you know, active in the field of design, various fields of design from what, the 1940s through the 1980s, right?
Mm, yeah.
Wow.
and furniture, filmmaking, toy design, you know, art installations, you name it, they did something with it. So, yeah.
Yeah, it gets, and they're an awesome example of how it can get rather cross-disciplined, and they can actually inform each other in meaningful ways. And I think a lot of the aspects of design we want to concern ourselves with, to understand better, to be better advocates of it, would be, if you're trying to represent design to someone that maybe they are more familiar with classic painting, or maybe they're really into furniture. You can find ways to, you can find common ground. They will have experienced the same kind of concerns that you will want the conversations to build toward through other areas of design. It doesn't always just have to come from storytelling.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the best emails that I ever got when we were doing the Art and Story podcast, Mark Rudolph and Kevin Cross and I were doing that show. We got an email from a costume designer who works in Hollywood doing costume design, emailed us and he said, "Oh my God, I love your show. I don't draw comics. I'm a costume designer, but everything you guys talk about applies to my field as well. And it's fun listening to you guys and just changing the word comics to costume design. And it's as if you just made the show for me." And I thought, wow, we must be getting at it right if somebody can make that connection. Anyway, you got all these cards up on the screen. I'm curious what these are.
Okay. Well, let's see. Let me get rid of the drawing here. And I do have some cards. Some of them are review from last week, and we had a chance to see them. We talked about the sort of some of the forces of design that may be affecting you as you're going about it. And I think today we're going to bring it from those forces to then start talking about things you will face as an individual and what it would be like designing in a group, and sort of maybe those forces change, and we'll explore that, see where we land.
Okay. Sounds fun. Sounds like a good park to walk through.
Cool.
So heuristics, trial and error, rules of thumb. Heuristics. Yeah. How do you pronounce it? Is it heuristics or heuristics? The history or her story?
Good question. I would say it's whatever works for you. Heuristics. I'm from Minnesota. We pronounce lots of things funny. So I will go into wacky accent, don't you know, once in a while. And what can you do? It's where I'm from. So we would say heuristics, I think.
Well, I'm from Michigan. It's almost Minnesota, so I'll say heuristics too.
Okay. So, yeah, here we have our rules of thumb, trial and error, critical thinking over time. This is one of the things that I think we should just kind of jump around with this. Like, one of the best could be, and part of it, this is totally self-serving, is that heuristics have helped me a lot in team situations.
Interesting. How?
Because they're often, you can express it as a test and then have someone else detect if that design concern is present or not. So it becomes a rule of thumb. So I will, in the case of like designing screens and working in a team in a software environment, and if I design a set of screens and they have a certain layout and a certain set of positioning and grouping of elements and other style attributes, like when you'd style a web page, like font and font weight and what have you. And if someone were developing and not as concerned about those design concerns, then they may miss certain things. And a rule of thumb can help you notice if you're missing that or not. Because if you've never really thought about, it's a classic software development dynamic. I would assume I'm not offending anyone in saying that a lot of times when a designer puts out a screen, a strength and weakness that can happen there is maybe they're not thinking of the platform and thinking, well, you don't actually have this control in your toolbox, but hey, it looks cool and I made it up. Good luck, developer. And then developer is like, putting stuff together, making it all work, and then it works at the end of the day, but maybe it looks laid out a little bit not as tight. Right. So how do you, so it's interesting. These things can work both ways as far as design concerns. Honestly, it doesn't
this
just have to be
in the
visual.
World of print design as well. I remember when I was working at the newspaper and we were dealing with was like a 133 line screen, very low res stuff because it was being printed on newsprint. And we'd get these kids who'd come in. I was a kid too, but I mean, like, there was always the new guy who was going to come in. He was going to shake up the world of newspaper coupon advertising design. And I'm going to use gradients, and it's going to have 12 different colors of purple on it. Never mind that it's a spot color. And then the pressman would call us and say, hey, this ad is not, it's going to look like crap if you try to print it like this. You got to simplify it. And so then you get into these rules of thumb of, yeah, gradients, probably not a good idea. You know, if you're going to be printing on newsprint, you know, if you're going to be doing a spot color, two different variations of shade of the spot color for a coupon clipping advertisement. You don't want to go beyond that. It's not a hard and fast rule. I'm sure somebody can break that rule and come up with something really unique and dynamic. But as a general rule, in order to keep the production moving smoothly and keep the pressmen from calling us up and screaming at us, keep it simple, right? You know, because you got to work with limitations of the technology.
Yes, exactly. You're addressing a constraint, and design often deals with constraints. And you can test these boundaries and see where you can stretch and change them and whatnot, and make a new version of your rule of thumb, or maybe an exception or what have you. But having it in the first place, so for me, one of the common things is I would come up with column layout guidelines, and it will help with the overall alignment and readability of form-based user interfaces, right? Where that stuff can be easy to lose track of. And just having some simple column guidelines and how do you treat things? How do you have a common harmonious alignment? And especially if it's expressed in ways that make sense to a developer audience where they're like, oh, okay, cool. I know how to set this alignment on that control and do. It becomes a simple rule of thumb, easy to enforce. And then the final product, because not every step passed through my hands as a designer, it still has the strong desire. You know, it has the desired effect. The end result looks like the intended result. Mm-hmm. And yeah, rules of thumb are kind of awesome for that. And they can help. I mean, I would say they're helpful individually because then you can give yourself shortcuts. Mm-hmm. So you can get up to speed quickly if you're like, oh man, it's been a while since I've been on this project, and then look a few things up and say, oh yeah, we based all of the size choices on 2EM of Myriad, and it makes everything visually harmonious because we everything was some multiplier of that. Like you'd have a
golden ratio that we talked about.
Exactly.
One, right? Like a ratio that replicates itself tends to, we're going to group those images. We're going to group those things together in our mind. We're going to make sense and order out of that. Just like when you're looking at a cloud and you say Volkswagen or praying mantis, because our minds are conditioned to look for those patterns and make order out of what looks on the surface to be chaos, right?
Wait a minute. Volkswagen, do Volkswagens resemble a praying mantis?
Volkswagen, comma, praying mantis.
Okay. No, I thought, oh my gosh, I never saw it before. I am missing out.
Yeah, we talked about this last time, right? It's like, yeah, which one looks more man-made, right?
Yes, exactly. And right now I'm just sort of, I'm so zoomed in, I'm not seeing my slides overall. So let's see. Yeah, we were going through those design forces, and I think, you know, for the most part, we covered heuristics in high detail, personal opinion. Oh boy, gosh, each of these makes an interesting point in the whole individual versus a group design situation, don't they?
Yeah, because like, okay, group design decision would be, if we go by heuristics and rules of thumb, going back to my coupon clipper days as an example, if you want an ad that looks like it's a 30% off coupon, you probably want to put a dotted line border around the ad. Clip this out. You get 30% off your thing, right? That dotted line indicates cut me out, use me for something. I'm a functional piece of this newspaper.
It's a call to action in a way.
Call to action. And most designers in our department would agree that that's an effective tool. It seems to work and the clients seem to like it. Personal opinion would be, is that going to have a rounded corner or a square corner? Nobody's going to argue that it's a coupon, whether it has a rounded corner or a square corner. But we had people in there who were like, it must have a rounded corner. That's a smoother thing. It's easier to cut, and it blends better with the other surrounding elements. No, you want to use the square one because square represents like more of a grid style, and it looks more like something that you cut straight clip, straight clip, straight clip. You know, that was the kind of arguments people got into in that department. But that's
sure, you're going to make people feel bad if they're not following that curve. Be like, oh, look at this sloppy coupon.
Yeah, right. Yeah. My safety scissors can't do those kind of jagged quick corners. But yeah, that in a nutshell is the difference between operating from rules of thumb and then going to your personal opinion. I want to do the ad that has the blue spot color because I think that the cyan looks better with this particular arrangement of elements. That's a personal gut reaction. Is it objectively better? That's hard to debate. An example I like to think about is Filmation's cartoons of the 80s. If you look at, or 70s even, 70s and 80s, you look at those shows, the sky can be any color that the color director wanted it to be that day. The sky is not blue. It is not objectively blue. The sky is whatever color meets the mood of the scene. If it's a scary scene, the sky's going to be red, or it's going to be purple and black. If it's a happier scene, it's going to be either green or yellow, maybe blue, but it's going to be a brighter, happier color, happier in quotes, right?
That is a pretty cool, clever device. Like, yeah. Really efficient. Obviously, you can just put one big splotch of color out there and get a sort of a general reaction from it.
Oh, man, look at the skies and all those Filmation cartoons. Man, I could just stare at their backgrounds for hours. They had one guy in charge of their whole color department. That guy was a master. I mean, I put him in the same grouping as, like, whoever did the color keying for the Craig McCracken cartoons, Powerpuff Girls. You've seen those, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, Powerpuff Girls, the movie. Man, that movie, what they do with color is just, I'm still picking it apart. And I'm going to rewatch it again before I dive into my new comics. I really want to kind of get under the hood of this color theory stuff. But again, that's something where, you know, that's not an objective thing, right? That's not, but it's based on some heuristics, though. Because, like, when I was talking about happy colors, warmer colors for, like, lighter moments of the story versus dark reds, blood reds, purples and blacks for scarier moments of the story, that's a heuristic. That's a rule of thumb.
It is. And actually, some of that is cultural based. So a lot of it's based on sort of traditions and stories and whatnot that cultures embrace that gives meaning to color, because color doesn't inherently have meaning.
Yeah, like that joke in Project Daco. You've seen Project Daco, yeah?
I have not, actually. I'm surprised.
What?
Yeah,
an anime.
I know. It's an area that I'm almost well versed in, but
it's
not quite.
Well, it's been 20 years since I've seen it, but as I remembered, it was a big send up to a lot of the popular animes at the time. Like it riffed on a whole bunch of different animes, and I believe it was an Akira send up they were doing within the story, and a guy's in this tunnel, and all of a sudden a scary form starts walking towards him, and it's Colonel Sanders from Kentucky Fried Chicken. And he's all in white, right? Southern gentleman, all in white. And it's this terrifying moment of the story. And when I was, you know, in my late teens, early 20s, I was like, I guess I'd have to be in my late teens. I didn't get the joke. I was like, what's those? I guess it's an absurdist thing. But no, I found out later that white is a death motif in Japan. It was referring to the fact that when Kentucky Fried Chicken came to Japan, here's this mascot. It'd be like if we imported some Japanese restaurant and the Grim Reaper was their mascot, right? Come meet at Sickle's Death Cutter Hamburger Shack.
Eat a sickle sandwich. There you go.
Anyway, sorry. Didn't mean to go off on that.
Culture. And there's subcultures, and it's not even because obviously with your death example, hey, you know what? That totally appeals to some subcultures, right? And you know, they get meaning playing off of that. Obviously as a character, I've always enjoyed that. Ever since Piers Anthony's book On a Pale Horse. So anyway.
Yeah, I saw your tweet today where you were talking about going gray, and you were hoping that the hair stays long so you can go full on Gandalf. And I was like, wow, that's so cool. That might know a guy who like will actually look like Gandalf, and he'll like be like my age, you know. That would make growing old kind of cool, because I can't do it. I don't have the stuff on top of my scalp
knows?
To do that. But you need to know a guy who actually looks like Gandalf.
I'll do my best.
But anyway.
Yeah. So
we talked about fashion last time too. Mm-hmm. So where next? We want to talk about personal experiences versus designing with a group, right?
Yeah. What's funny is now I have all four of these sort of on the screen at the same time, because I think we can refer back to it, and each of them we could talk about. Well, what does this design force do in relation to when you have with you as an individual, and then what, how does it affect when you're dealing with a design as a team, right? So you have a project that's completely within your control and a project that isn't. And so what does that do? And I think there's other ways to look at it too. When projects are completely within your control, you still may want to give up some control because you want to have it achieve a certain desired effect. Explain. So I look at it as, are you building or doing the thing or making something as an act of expression, pure expression, or is it an act of service? And I think you can do an act of service where you're creating something that's meant to, well, maybe you're getting paid for that, right? And so you have other roles and perspectives to address.
Yep.
In bringing that about. Or you just decided, you know what? I want to make sure that this website is really, really fun for 8 to 12-year-olds.
Yep.
And you picked an audience, and it's your project, and you want to, but by choosing to serve, that changes things up.
I didn't think about it that way, but yeah, when you do choose to serve, you are relinquishing a certain level of control, aren't you? You're submitting yourself to another, even if it's an imagined group, their concerns, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You don't get to say, well, to heck with it, my kid's story is going to have the main character's head get blown off on page one, right? To heck with it, my story is going to start with a gratuitous rape scene.
Sure. Or almost any scene from Kill Bill.
Yeah.
One and two. Yeah. Pretty much all of it's out.
Whoa, you're right. Now that I think about it, yeah. Holy cow.
Maybe you can have a conversation with the martial arts trainer, the sword master. A couple of those. Like a hi, how's it going kind of thing.
Yep. Yeah, 15 seconds. 15 seconds.
A few seconds here and there.
Well, not that's many. Tarantino's his prerogative, right? He's got his style. He's got his voice. And he knows what his audience is. Like doesn't present Kill Bill as being like fun for the whole family.
No. And, you know, but maybe that helps shape his concerns too, because and you could actually find ways where they overlap. You could find out where your natural expression is very well met with a given audience to serve.
Right.
Which that would probably be a more efficient thing to design for you than something where it's not well met.
To concretize what you just said, you know, people ask me sometimes, like when I tell them, like whenever I team up with another collaborator or take on a freelance job, I throw out this rule up front is that I don't draw anything over PG-13. I just don't. And they said, the question is always put back to me is like, is that a religious thing? Is that a moral thing? Like, no. It's just that's where I'm comfortable. That's where I know I'll do my best work. And whenever I've tried to go outside of that realm and do something a little bit more edgy than PG-13, I always fail. I'm just bad at that. So I've learned over 17, whatever, however many years I've been doing this, to draw a line around that and say, this is the territory where I can feel at ease. So sometimes, you will find a limitation works, jives well with who you are as a person, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's... So you can avoid the stress. I mean, sure, you could try things that there's been a lot of, I don't know, team management, business, pop psychology, philosophy that's all about find your weakness and deal with that. But you could just stick with what you like and enjoy too, and just hang out with your strength and have a better time of it.
Yeah, then I just defer back to the Star Trek V where Kirk says, "I need my pain."
Pain's there you go.
Makes us who we are. But okay, so let's talk about, okay, so which you want to take on first? You want to take on designing for yourself with these four forces and then go with working with a group?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So I could give you another example of how I'm facing working as a service on a project I'm designing. I just got the contract for the second book of the Captain Seriously series. You remember
awesome.
That?
Awesome. Congrats, man. Yeah, nice. Captain Seriously. Yeah, you've you had some good Thunder Punch dailies that talked about that.
That's right. I did cover that in Thunder Punch Daily, that other microcast thing that I do from time to time. But it was, yeah, for those who haven't heard of it, it's a comic book universe I created for a nonprofit organization called Seriously in Chelsea, Michigan. And it's a multi-year project. I started year one with a coloring book. It was a coloring book comic for second graders. And every year I'm going to revisit a new story with these characters, and we're going to progressively age up the content to follow these kids along. These kids are getting their own personal superhero universe that I get to create for them.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a bit of a dream job. I mean, I'm getting paid well. I'm getting paid like a really good page rate to do what I love best for an age group that I like working for. So, yeah. But it's a service. I am working mm-hmm. with the public school board. I'm working with the principal, superintendent, third and fourth grade teachers. There's a committee of teachers who are going to be reviewing the material that I'm creating for them. They are providing me with topics and ideas that they want the story to address, you know? And
yeah.
I was in a meeting 3 days ago, and do you want to talk about magic tricks? I know that it's kind of silly for me to be proud of this moment, but at the same time, I don't mind being proud of this moment, where they said, like, can you come up with a 12-page story that addresses courage and principles and what was the other point? There was like another subtopic about making good choices and working with your family. And without, like, I had just enough time to draw a breath, and then I threw a 12-second pitch for a story at them. And because they don't write, right? These aren't writers. Mm-hmm. They don't know what all the years of experience that went into me being able to do this. To them, it was a magic trick. But there was this instant turning of wheels where, you know, when I was putting this idea together to explore, okay, there would be two different convergent themes that are expressed one way through the bad guys, one way through the good guys, and it teaches kids this. But I have to be able to say, well, you know what? My favorite thing to draw in the entire world is something blowing up and somebody flying through the air. I want a guy whose chest opens up and a chain gun comes out of it. Not very appropriate for a third grade classroom. You know, little boys think that's cool. Doesn't mean it's good for them.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so it's like I can skirt the edges. You know, it's going to have a lot of action in it because I am in service to those kids. I got to write a story that's exciting for them. I'm also in service to the client who wants me to write something that has an educational and pro-social component to it. And then I'm in service to myself as an artist in the sense that I want to create something that's artfully done as best I can within these restrictions so that it's not didactic. It's not preaching at kids and the characters aren't turning to the kids midway through the story saying, remember, fighting's bad. No, let them have the fun ride. The good choices will come through in the context of the narrative. The kids are smart enough to pick up on that, but design it so that it's loud enough that the client will like it, right? So that, in a nutshell, is what I'm an example of managing your design as a service, right? Make it exciting enough. I designed a character for it named Baron Mendacious, who is a... an evil lizard man with orange lizard skin, and he wears a big fancy purple coat, and he's sort of like Errol Flynn as a lizard man villain. And I originally had him with a giant pistol on his chest, great big cartoony, you know, Looney Tunes style pistol on his chest. And they said, ditch the gun. No guns on this comic. This is going to be distributed in public schools. Okay, well, compromise. Can I have him have a fancy sword? Yes. Okay. So again, going back to rules of thumb, probably not a good idea to have a guy who has missiles for teeth or, you know, a giant gun in a holster or anything explosive or incendiary. But you can have some fantasy swordplay. You know, you can do that. He can have fire breath, but he can't shoot a gun, right?
Yeah, sure. Too near to possible reality.
Right. You have to make it a little bit more fantasized. And that's going off of a rule of thumb. Personal opinion. There were people who disagreed with some of the character designs they came up with based on their own opinion. The story I've told the most is when I created the character who was a cat, but she was a lady. Dame Lady Cat. And one of the people on the committee said kids have a tough time identifying with talking animal characters. I don't know what informed that opinion, but, you know, that turned into a discussion.
It's, yeah.
What?
It's so funny. Everyone has different learning styles, different culture. So many different things can influence, especially the world of communication, because you're looking at things that are that you can do some science surrounding, but a lot of the science is more of that tested expertise that you end up forming your heuristics that you can stand by it confidently, and you can back it up. Possibly, if you wanted to do some kind of double-blind study, probably be able to prove some of the theories that you've got your heuristic-based rules of thumb that you're following. But at the same time, you know what? You're too busy getting stuff done.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's necessarily fun to study on it.
And to make sure that people understand that I'm not trying to tell stories out of school, as it were. It wasn't a fight. It was more of a discussion. It turned into a discussion where we said, yeah.
Well, no, and I didn't mean as far as that necessarily, but versus like more physics-based measurements, like saying, well, okay, we're designing a chair and maybe we're disagreeing a little bit about does the edge have a bevel on it or not and how thick will the pad be, but we're all in agreement that the welds on the chair need to, you know, be able to withstand such amount of torque, such amount of pressure from these different angles or whatever, because we can do the math on it, right? Where you're in an area that it's math might help you a little bit, but it's not going to help you navigate these soft presentations and discussions, right? Where all of a sudden you have this personal opinion conflict and you can't whip out an equation and go like, well, cat equals awesome, done.
Yeah. I mean, I did pull out some examples of popular literature, right? The Mouse and the Motorcycle, Charlotte's Web, lots of anthropomorphized animal stories that I was able to go, well, wait a minute, these are taught in classrooms. Charlotte's Web is a second grade text, right? So, or third grade text, maybe.
But anyway. Animal Farm, Stuart Little.
Yep. But then we can go into design principles. You've gotten here, you know, cost, visual information, visual communication, architecture, usability, aesthetics. When it came to designing the characters, aiming it at a second grade audience, the designs had to be simple, clear, vibrant. I'm not going to do a Jim Lee drawing. I'm not going to do one of those Spawn drawings that we looked at in the last design session, right? I'm going to keep the design of the characters fairly open, open contoured, you know, using sharp shapes for bad guys, round shapes for good guys, that kind of simple thinking. But also in the dialogue. In an early draft of the story, I had a character named Turnbuckle Tootweiler, who is this my zesty Southerner character. It's one of my go-to things. I love inserting a zesty Southerner in all of my stories if I can. And writing that Southern dialect, right? Instead of writing the word letter I, referring to yourself, you write A-H, ah, you know. Or instead of my, M-Y, it's M-A-H, ma. And I wrote this dialogue and the committee came back to me and said, you know, you're dealing with second graders and they're just learning a lot of spelling. And if you throw in dialect, it's going to be weird and confusing. You know, maybe when you get to fifth grade, you can do something like this. But for now, he needs to speak in proper English because that's, you know, part of the overall the struggles we're facing as an environment in these classrooms. Totally understood. Totally understood. I was not going to fight that battle because that's a design principle of the age group we're working with. We have to, you know, keep this consistent with what everything else that they're learning.
Sure. It's sort of an educational reinforcement. It's part of their overall educational system, right?
Totally. So I would be actually working against what they're trying to achieve in those classrooms by introducing that in there. And I think about the Spidey Super Stories from the Electric Company. Remember those? The comics they did in the late 70s?
Absolutely.
Where it was Spider-Man comics, but it was told in this sort of early grade school language of Dr. Doom fighting the Silver Surfer, and there was a lot of rhyming in it, you know. I'm Dr. Doom, like sugar and spice. I'm sweet and nice for now, you know. He was still sinister, but he spoke in this very simple kind of sing-song language that was easy for first or second grader to pick up on. Even had Easy Reader, the Electric Company character, Morgan Freeman, on the cover of every book. You know, this book is easy to read. And then we get to fashion, right? It's like, so I'm also thinking about when I design this kind of stuff, what are kids interested in right now? How can I bring some of those principles or those kinds of ideas and that kind of ethos to what I'm doing? you know, it, when I look at what kids are watching on TV, Phineas and Ferb, or say Pokemon, kids are still really into Pokemon. I'm going to look at what are the common themes and common shared qualities of aesthetics and design principles that are going on with these different things. What are the intangible qualities that are kind of coming through in between the lines with the characters? And how can I come approach that and bring it up to what is currently in fashion for kids now so they feel like this is modern and for them? I approach this thing with a Wally Wood type of illustration style or a Will Eisner type of illustration style. They'll probably still like it, but it's going to feel different to them, right? Because I'm working with an older set. This is Daddy's comics. This isn't my comics, right?
That is a thing, too. And depending on the audience, it can also it can be a little bit dissonant where it's not for them. It's from some other, and for some kids that could be enticing. Like, wow, this is different. That's really cool. I know, at certain ages for me, that would have been off-putting. I'm like, that's not kind of fluffy and goofy like Bugs Bunny. Right. I don't trust it.
A good example is that, again, from my own personal experience, when I was a kid who was raised on Silver Age DC, I didn't have a comic store in the town I grew up in. I was in a very rural community where literally there was the general store and the hardware store. That was it. Right, so you just went to the little general corner store to get a loaf of bread and milk, but there wasn't like a big box store. There was no comic store, nothing, not even a spinner rack of comics. And so, it was very Andy Griffith, very Andy Griffith. Everybody knew everybody else's business there. Parents come home with a big box of comics they got at a secondhand bookstore with the covers all ripped off, all from the 60s. Now, remember, this is 1982, 83, so these comics weren't that old yet, right? And it's like, we're only going back a couple decades. Think about it now. Yeah. It's like that, getting a box of Image comics from 1992 now.
Sure, or a Nirvana CD.
Yeah. That put it in perspective. So, I mean, this box is full of Kurt Swan Supermans, Superman's girlfriend Jimmy, or Lois Lane, Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, Supergirl, Casper the Friendly Ghost, Hot Stuff, Richie Rich, all these old Harvey comics, Magnus Robot Fighter. And so for years, that's what I thought comics were. It was this very kind of like clean, friendly DC Comics, Harvey Comics approach to storytelling. Fifth grade, a friend of mine introduces me to Alpha Flight by John Byrne. Are you familiar with John Byrne's work?
No.
John Byrne was really big in the mid to late 80s and into the 90s. But his stuff is, compared to like Kurt Swan stuff, very edgy, very like a lot of ink lines, a lot of feathering, but like kind of like this weird bloopy feathering. And Alpha Flight itself was kind of like this dark, kind of occultish superhero comic compared to a lot of other stuff going on at the time. And a friend of mine, he's like, "Oh, you should read this if you like comics." And I read it and it was culture shock. I was like, what is this scary thing? This isn't superheroes. Superheroes don't do this scary stuff. There's monsters with like an entire face made out of teeth in this. Superman doesn't fight guys like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you can create, like you said, a dissonance by introducing them to something that is utterly unfamiliar to them, not in accordance with what everything else they're consuming at the time. Now, I'm not trying to say that I'm trying to do bromidic work or trying to do work that is homogenized and overprocessed.
But pandering.
What's that?
Pandering.
Yeah. That's something I take very seriously. I do my very best to not talk down to my audience. But at the same time, when I'm doing a piece of work that's meant to appeal to the broadest possible audience of a certain demographic, and I'm doing it in service to somebody who's paying me well for it, I'm going to do my best to make sure that I have eliminated all possibility that it's going to be rejected by the audience, right? I'm going to do my level best to make sure that this appeals to the widest possible group of kids. So there's not going to be a kid in there who opens up that book and says, "Oh, I hate this." And one way to ensure that is to look at the fashion of the time and play within those boundaries and not just rip off wholesale. I didn't put Pikachu in there, but I thought Pikachu is pretty cool. Why is Pikachu cool? Well, because he's really brave and he's really tough, but he's also really cute. Okay, Dame Lady.
Exactly. Oh, sure, yeah. You borrowed from the same forces some defining attributes, but then took it a different direction.
Yep. And I like drawing cats. But anyway, I think that story, that tells the story of working in service for somebody on your own. Yeah.
I think it does. Yeah. And it, I'm going to bring in a funky philosophy word that I think unifies the topic in both the directions, because as individuals, what we're creating, I think, is affected by this. And when we are, of course, doing what we create as a service, and it's actually the name of an open source OS too, Ubuntu. And we'll put this in the show notes and whatnot, but it's the definition of it is I am what I am because of who we all are.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah.
What language is that?
It is, let's see, is an African ethic or Hema's philosophy from the Bantu languages of Southern Africa.
Hmm.
Yeah, pretty awesome word. And because obviously, you know, we're all soaked in our cultures and whatnot that aren't just about us. And so that's going to shape what we create as individuals, even if it's if it's to serve our expression on its own. It's not totally on its own. That's what I think that concept of Ubuntu acknowledges. And also that, and there's different ways our link will point to the Wikipedia page that points out others' interpretation of that. And of course, in service to others, and when we're trying to make certain art with certain expression, and it has a certain design, it's built on the best of what we know and how to do it with the materials, with the message and the effect that we're trying to achieve and the goals and the medium and all the factors that affect what we're making. It's this other thing that it's all this that's available is also affecting that. Yeah. And it's, yeah.
This anyway. Is why we'll never run out of material to talk about this stuff, because it's very, very dense and layered. And anybody who says that this stuff isn't interesting is... I envy them their happy life.
And I would say that they may be the ones who say that and then they look at you like, you know? They're the ones that we want to then say, well... Are you sure? I mean, that actually design is actually, it's pretty useful and you actually deal with it all the time. Think about the car you drove today and how it looks and how the seats are shaped and what kind of accidents it's meant to both avoid and survive.
So how does this experience that I just relayed, how does that change with these four forces when we talk about working or not doing it in service, but doing it as a force of self-expression?
The self-expression is really about, it doesn't have, what's funny is self-expression can be very intentional. And I also think it can be just very, very raw, incidental, driven by just your action because you felt like acting. Mm-hmm. So it's really serving yourself.
Yeah.
And if your project is more about your expression and how would it affect that project? Because of some of your interests already, in some ways it wouldn't affect that project because it's already the audience that you want to reach out to for the most part. But then some of the other concerns would no longer be sort of tests of validity of is this design robust for its purpose? So you would probably set aside. I mean, so things like turnbuckle Tutwiler's spicy Southerner accent would probably be kept.
Does that mean this area, the personal opinion area, becomes a little bit stronger in the overall mix?
It becomes stronger for yourself because it's a force no matter what. Like when you're dealing with some group that you're trying to serve and individuals in that group, the personal opinion will drive many of your conversations toward bringing your project to completion.
I just turned in seven different character designs for a new character we're introducing into the story. And all I had was a name and a function for the character. Now come up with seven different looks so we can decide which character to do. One of the designs I did, I found myself saying, well, what would they want? And I did that, and I rumpled it up, threw it away, because I said all these designs should be based on what I want, and yes, try to be in service to them, but I got to design something that I think is cool, that I'm going to have fun drawing. Otherwise, this job is going to be torture, right? So personal opinion came in strong even when in working in service to others, right? Because that's why they hired me.
Exactly. That's one of the things, obviously, that we are celebrating is your voice and what you're bringing to the table to the project in addressing the design needs. It's not just about the needs. It's not just about the audience, because weird ideas like Ubuntu don't just affect you optionally. They're going to affect you incidentally. And so you may as well embrace it and be intentional about it. That's my flat out bias.
Yeah.
Because that way you have the chance to tap into it and make the most out of it. You're realizing that, oh yeah, I'm here because they want my voice. It may make them feel a little bit better because they somehow, you read their mind and you expressed that in a character. And now they get to see their mind externalized. But did they have all the same subtle experiences and concerns that you've tested over the years that would have driven your other designs that you dismissed to create this other design? Mm-hmm. And would it hold up as well? You know, so maybe sometimes it's the classic problem of the Homer.
Yeah.
So
you better tell everybody what you're talking about there.
So the Homer is what you get when you do exactly what someone asks because they asked it. And it was an awesome Simpsons episode. So the Simpsons cartoon where Homer Simpson meets his long lost brother, who happens to be sort of like an auto industry, muckety muck, high up, whatnot. And he's able to give his brother, Homer, long lost brother, like carte blanche, make whatever car you need. And Homer makes the most horrible, horrendous, crazy. And obviously not everyone would go to this extreme. But people will sacrifice different concerns when they're just drowning in their own, meeting their own needs through their own personal opinion and not as experienced in dealing with what you would deal with normally with your design concerns. So yeah, I mean, Homer adds like, it's a, what's funny is I think there must be a Jetsons episode that gets kind of similar, because I remember they had like some weird, either that or it was just an homage where they had the mother-in-law bubble, right? Kind of thing. And didn't the Homer have that, or was that where the kids were? Anyway.
Well, I got it right here. Yeah.
Oh, there you go. There's a secondary bubble thing. That must have been the kids' zone or whatever.
One of my favorite jokes from that episode is when he's designing the dashboard and he's telling the engineers, there's never a horn around when you need one, so we need a horn here, 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 and here.
Oh, my.
So, and he ruins.
It's got a step to go in. It's got a lance or something built into the side?
It's like a lance coming out of the side mirror. There's a bowling trophy on the grill of the car.
Yeah, which is like a Rolls Royce, ridiculously emphatic grill.
Yeah.
Ah, yes. So that's what you get.
This is what happens when you follow instructions to the letter. And I have designed print advertisements that are the print advertisement version of this car.
And I've been on projects when I've been in a situation where I've lost the battle and I've built the Homer once in a while. I do everything in my power as a storyteller and a communicator and as an intentional artist in this world to not end up in that position, but I still do once in a while. But anyway.
It does happen. It does happen sometimes when you're working in the service of others.
Yep.
When people have very specific ideas about what they want.
And there's an interesting thing to highlight. There's one thing that we missed that I want to circle back to that you mentioned. I think it's a magic trick. But when you get into, personal opinion in the group and, oh gosh, in the highlight of the old opinion, old issue, I'm losing the current one I wanted to do. All right. Circle back. Magic trick. in the service of others. So we're circling back to service of others, and something that you mentioned, Jersey, about bringing together different concerns, and how do you sort of so you're addressing things like your rules of thumb, you're addressing needs and sort of measures that are expressed to say this is what will make the design successful. Like, it has to fit into our educational system. It has to make, you know, sort of relate to it in a positive way and reinforce things and whatnot. And you actually mentioned a magic trick that is so subtle that I just want to emphasize heavily. And it's the idea that you said that you mentioned using yourself as one of the clients. So you put yourself in this situation where in your list of people to make sure that you get your buy-in and approval to get through phases and get, you know, to get successful delivery on different aspects of the project and different stages. Well, along the way, make sure you're one of them.
Yeah.
And that way you don't lose track of it and you don't get lost in the whole other people's personal opinion.
I think what you're talking about, though, comes with there has to be a sense of self-awareness, self-confidence, and experience to inform that. And I think it's something where if you're new to this thing, it's definitely worth reminding yourself of that. Because when you first start freelancing, you just want those jobs so bad that you don't want to argue with anybody, right?
It's not the arguing, it's the how. Because I would say that absolutely. You're going to run into, and here's, oh, you're awesome, Jersey. You brought me back to the other point too, because they relate. It has to do with this shared outcome. And honestly, the word that we've avoided to this point is control. And that's what happens when you're working, individually and you're just serving your own, needs, and you're not worried about doing this as a service, it's purely expression. You have ramped the control knob all the way to you. Mm-hmm. And when a client brings you in to help design something, no matter what it is, they have somehow turned down the control knob that isn't no longer pointing just to them anymore. And depending on the client, they may want that to point back to them and just have you sign off on it.
Yeah.
Or they may be okay with many gradations in between. And I think without broaching the topic, without participating in the conversation, including your perspective, you've dismissed your abilities and at least testing them. Like, well, even if it is your first contract, I think it's plenty safe to do it. I think the risk comes in how you present it.
Yes. I've been present when a designer was arguing with an advertising representative at one of the different advertising places I worked. Mm-hmm. When the designer said, well, you don't have a design degree. I do.
Oops.
Listen to me. Yep. That conversation was over. Then the ad rep got to say, I brought in the client. I'm the one who keeps this place functioning. You shut up and listen to me. And a completely different way to go about it is, I wonder what would happen if we tried this. And then, right? Let me just tweak this. Let me see what happens if we do this. Oh, that's interesting. What do you think, ad guy? Do you like that?
Right. A shared what if.
Yeah. Yep. Completely different way of doing it. That's whether you're going to go on full on karate or if you're going to do judo or aikido, right? So, but yeah. But well, cool. I think an important thing to remember is that you brought this thing of control, and even in my personal projects, even in the projects where it is purely my self-expression. Like, let's take this front comic I'm working on. This is for me. Right? I have no hopes that anybody's going to read this. A handful of people read the original story, and a few people trickle in every once in a while who discover it and say, this is neat. But it's by no means, you know, I've never had an article written about that comic. I've never gotten any awards or anything like that. So I'm putting this comic out there just for the pure pleasure of doing the comic. It's a purely self-indulgent experience. However, I do have an audience. I have an audience of one. That's me. And I got to think about how am I going to service that audience, right? And this particular audience has very specific tastes that I took the trouble to sit down and address and write down. What is it about my favorite things that makes me go back to them again and again? Why do I cry every time I watch certain He-Man episodes? Mm. Oh, man, I didn't mean to admit that publicly.
But, nothing wrong with that. But
so, okay, identifying that I'm my client. And to a certain degree, I lose a little bit of control in service to myself, if that makes any sense, right? Anything I've ever done that I've ever been really pleased with, I've always relinquished a certain degree of control in service to either myself as an audience or an imagined audience, where I said, what would Anne like, right? Mm-hmm. What would make her laugh? Oh, I'll do that, and that'll help make, it'll lead to a cascading effect of decision-making that wouldn't be there before, so...
And maybe that's an interesting thing in how we just, not everyone feels that way as far as the relinquishing of control and their flexible relationship with the idea of control. And I think that will probably affect your designs quite a bit, both individually and in service to others. And even if, and where if you're doing it in service to yourself, that still is an interesting way to sort of get outside yourself. And it's not just a raw expression of this came out this way, therefore it is right.
I feel like we got a whole another sub episode based on control in design. I think we're gonna be able to spend easily an hour on that one.
Yep.
Oh man, especially when you talk to somebody who's fresh out of school and they have a professor's sort of viewpoint impressed upon them, where in a grades basis, and I'm not slagging anybody who goes to design school or art school, by no means, but a lot of people will agree with me that your first year or two out of college, you're sort of unlearning a lot of stuff that you learned in college when you start doing it in, for real, so to speak.
And it's like a forced integration of you were able to sort of do that in kind of a scientific isolated experience, which that is wonderful to have been able to do that. What awesome thing to focus on. But then, boy, is the world fuzzy and dirty when it comes to delivering that and somehow making it mean something, which is partially the impetus, the reason why I want to try to take a swing at advocating design and understanding it more and sharing that with this audience. And
I want to talk more about control though, because I've had situations where my eagerness to relinquish control and to, in working with group environments where I've had that blow up in my face, like really blow up in my face where it's like, oh, well we can all do this, right guys? And this is like day job, like design work stuff, when I was like working in a corporate design department on the 10th floor of a corporate building where the VP's office was right over there, that kind of environment. And
sure,
my kind of loose approach to management, as it were, I didn't have the title manager, but I was the lead designer, even though I was paid the same as everybody else. Don't you love that? That's always a fun one. You're the lead designer. That means you got twice the responsibility, but you don't get paid any better. Where that loose approach, it really came back and bit me on the butt. So sometimes, you do need to have more control and be that. There's always this balance of tension between, like, some people think you got to be that pushing visionary pioneer who drives everybody and everybody hates you, but you make a brilliant thing as a result of that. Or there's the Jim Henson approach where it's like, he worked hard, but he also made sure to keep a spirit of play involved in there all the time. So there's a spectrum there that'll be fun to talk about, I think.
Yeah, it's I'm sold. Let's dive into that one in another episode. It absolutely will relate back to this one, because how your relationship with the idea of control is going to affect how you go about these the task of design, and whether it's in service to yourself as a pure form of expression, or maybe we've got sort of this middle ground one too, where it's a different kind of expression for yourself, but it's really serving yourself as opposed to just being raw animal yourself, right? I don't know what to say.
Maybe that's part of my problem. Yeah, I've never been to Primal Scream therapy, you know? I don't know what would happen if I did that.
Yep. Get out the brush and some, you know, lay all sorts of paper around and get wild. I don't know.
I don't know what would happen. I'm scared. we got to dig a little bit further at this whole business of working, designing for yourself, but then also we didn't really talk about designing in groups. So I think control is the place to go next and talk about.
Sounds good.
Designing with a group for a purpose, designing with a group for yourself, and get a little bit more at this designing for yourself stuff and how these four forces work on us. But we're coming awesome. Up on my hard stop again. I apologize.
And myself as well. So that's... Yeah, I think we took a good swing at it this time again, and we'll continue.
We'll press on. We'll keep calm and carry on. And talk more about design in the next video show. So
actually, I just want to admit, I'm already being primal. This whole thing, primal.
Even when you're being primal, you're being kind of calm and measured. That's Rob's problem. No, I bet there's a way to incur the wrath of Rob. We just haven't found it yet.
Yeah, you just have to put a guitar in my hand.
That's the way it comes out.
That's how it comes out.
All right. Well, hey, you know what? A great way. If you thought, dear listener, that this stuff was worth listening to, and we kind of plucked a few strings in your mind and made you go, huh, that's kind of neat. If Rob's diagram of these four forces helps you identify or organize your thoughts in your own personal design project, and when we say design, we mean just organizing anything into something to communicate, you could give us a little pat the back. You could thank us for our time and thought and research and organization that we do to make this show by going to iTunes, giving us a star review. Got a couple on there, but we could always go for more. It'd be really awesome if everybody who listens to the show on one day, let's just say, how about the day this episode airs, so the Friday when we put this show on the air, the moment you're listening to it, go to iTunes, give us a star review, then knock us up onto one of those what is it called, the featured page,
one of the exactly notable lists. That would be awesome.
That'd be super cool, because then that'd be all the more people who are availing themselves of this content, all the more people who could support us. And then that leads us to the next thing. So that was the free one. That's the free way you can support us. The if you really enjoy it and you're like, man, these guys deserve a tip. I really got a lot out of what I've been out of the last couple episodes of the show. You can go to leanintoart.com/workshops. There's a whole bunch of workshops in there. Not free, but hour-long videos of in-depth content. Just browse through the whole catalog there. Rob put together this really cool interactive catalog that you can rifle through and do searches by keyword. Some of these workshops, $25. Not a whole lot. You get a lot of content and it helps support us making this show. It'd be a great way to give us a kickback. So as we said before, the sponsor of this series of shows is leanintoart.com/workshops. So that's the number one way you can help us out. So anything else, Rob?
We'll be coming back again with another episode of the design series, and it may be the third and last. Yeah, thinking about design.
I think we got a lot of mileage.
Or, I don't know. We'll see too. I'm into the whole. We can leave people hungry, or we could do design series 1 and 2 or whatever too. So I'm flexible. I'm not. I lied. I'm not primal. I'm. You know what. This is partially up to me, up to Jersey, and up to you in the audience. So we can keep this one rolling, too, because, there's a, we've got a lot of material to get through. And, part of it is, it's deep. And I don't even think that we will fully cover it all, too. And I think it might be fun to actually, cover a few and then come back to it in 6 months or a year, too.
Yep, that's true. Okay. Well, then thanks to everybody for downloading and listening. We appreciate you giving us some of your day. And
Indeed, you honor us, and we appreciate it.
And until next time, I've been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.